to the capitalists exploiting the colony, not to mention Judas and his 30 pieces of silver. So I paid for the major sin by donating the money to the revolution, handing it to man at the basilica. "See what we're fighting against," he said. "Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners," droned the dowagers. "This is why we'll win," man said. "Our enemies are corrupt. We are not." The point of writing this is that the crapulent major was as sinful as Claude estimated. Perhaps he had even done worse than simply extort money, although if he did, it did not make him above average in corruption. It just made him average. The next evening, we parked down the street from the gas station by 7:30, wearing the UCLA sweatshirts and caps. If anyone noticed us, they would see, hopefully, UCLA students. My car had the stolen license plates affixed to it, my legitimate ones in the glove compartment. Every bit of distraction helped, but most important of all were the distractions we did not control but which I had anticipated. With my window rolled down, we could hear distant explosions from the city fireworks show, as well as a pop-up of occasional small arms fire as an individual celebrated independence. Smaller fireworks exploded closer, illegally detonated somewhere in this neighborhood, as people lit cherry bombs, launched the occasional streaker into the low sky, or burned through ammo belts of Chinese firecrackers. Bond was tense as we waited for the major, his jaw clenched tight and shoulders hunched, refusing to let me turn on the radio. "Bad memories?" I said. "Yeah." For a while, he said nothing more, both of us watching the gas station. Two cars pulled in and gassed up, then left. This one time, outside Sadek, the point man stepped on a bouncing Betty. A little pop when it bounces, then a big bang. I was two guys behind him, didn't get a scratch, but it blew his balls off. Worst part of all, the poor son of a bitch lived. I mumbled regretfully and shook my head, but otherwise had nothing more to offer, castration being something that was unspeakable. We watched two more cars gas up. There was only one favor I could perform for the crapulent major. "I don't want him to feel anything," I said. "He's not even going to see it coming." At 8, the crapulent major left the station. I waited until he turned the corner, then started the car. We drove to his apartment using a different route so he would not see us passing him. The 4th parking slot was open, and I parked the car there. I checked my watch. 3 minutes, 8 more until the major came. Bond took out the gun from the glove compartment and popped the cylinder open one more time to inspect the bullets. Then he clicked the cylinder into place and laid the gun on the red velour pillow in his lap. I looked at the gun and the pillow and said, "What if some of the stuffing gets blown onto him, and pieces of the cover? The police will see it and wonder what it is." He shrugged. "So no pillow. That means there'll be noise." Somewhere down the street, someone set off another string of Chinese firecrackers, the same kind I had enjoyed so much as a little boy during New Year's. My mother would light up the long red string, and I would plug my ears and screech along with my mother in the patch of garden next to our hut, while the serpent leapt this way and that, consuming itself from tail to head, or perhaps it was head to tail, ecstatically ablaze. "It's just one shot," I said after the firecrackers ceased. "No one's coming out to see what happened, not with all this noise." He looked at his watch. "All right, then." He slipped on a pair of latex gloves and kicked off his sneakers. I opened my door, got out, closed it softly, and took my position at the other end of the carport, next to the path leading from the sidewalk to the apartment's mailboxes. The path continued past the mailboxes to the 2 ground-floor apartments, the entrance to the first one 10 feet down. Poking my head around the corner, I could see the lights of the apartment through the curtains of the living room window, pulled shut. A tall wooden fence lined the other side of the path, and above it rose the wall of an identical apartment complex. Half of its windows were bathroom windows, and the other half were bedroom windows. Anyone at the windows on the second floor could see the path leading through the apartment, but would not be able to see into the carport. Bond walked on socked feet to his position, in between the 2 cars nearest to the path, where he knelt down and kept his head below the windows. I looked at my watch, 8:07. I held a plastic bag with a yellow happy face and the word "thank you" on it. Inside were the firecrackers and the oranges. "Are you sure you want to do this, son?" my mother said. "It's too late, Mama. I can't figure a way out." I was halfway finished with a cigarette when the major appeared in the carport for the last time. "Hey!" His face broke into a puzzled smile. He carried his lunchbox in his hand. "What are you doing here?" I forced myself to smile in return. Lifting the plastic bag, I said, "I was in the neighborhood. I thought I'd drop this off." "What is it?" He was halfway to me. "A gift for the 4th of July." Bon emerged from behind the car by which the major was walking, but I kept my gaze on the major. He was within 3 feet when he said, "Do they give gifts on the 4th of July?" The expression on his face was still puzzled. When I offered him the bag with both hands, he leaned forward to peer at its contents. Behind him, Bon walked up, noiseless on his socked feet and gun in hand. "You didn't have to," said the major. When he put his hands on the bag, it was the moment for Bon to shoot. But instead of pulling the trigger, Bon said, "Hey, Major." The major turned around, gift in one hand, lunchbox in the other. I stepped to one side and heard him start to say a word when he saw Bon, and then Bon shot him. The report echoed in the carport, hurting my ears. The major's skull cracked when his head hit the pavement, and if the bullet had not already killed him, perhaps the fall did. He lay flat on his back, the bullet hole in his forehead, a third eye, weeping blood. "Move," Bon hissed, tucking the gun into the waistband of his pants. As he knelt down and rolled the major onto his side, I leaned over the body and picked up the plastic bag, its yellow happy face freckled with blood. The major's open mouth was wrapped around the shape of his last word. Bon tugged the wallet out of the major's hip pocket, stood up, and pushed me toward the car. I looked at my watch, 8:13. I pulled out of the carport. A numbness descended on me, beginning from my brain and my eyeballs, and extending to my toes and fingers. "I thought he wasn't going to see it coming," I said. "I just couldn't shoot him in the back," he said. "Don't worry, he didn't feel a thing." I was not worried about whether the crapulent major felt a thing. I was worried about whether I felt a thing. We said nothing more, and before we reached our apartment, I pulled into an alley where we replaced the license plates. Then we went home, and when I took my sneakers off, I saw spots of blood on the white toes. I took the shoes into the kitchen and wiped them off with a wet paper towel before I dialed the general's number from the phone hanging by the refrigerator, its door decorated with the twin columns of my divided self. He answered on the second ring. "Hello," he said. "It's done." There was a pause. "Good." I hung up the phone, and when I returned to the living room with two glasses and a bottle of rye, I found that Bon had emptied the contents of the major's wallet onto the coffee table. "What do we do with this?" Bon asked. There was his social security card, his state ID, but no driver's license, as he did not have a car. A wad of receipts, $22, a handful of change, and some photos. A black and white one showed him and his wife on their wedding day, very young and dressed in Western garb. He had been fat back then, too. There was also a color photo of his twins at a few weeks of age, genderless and wrinkled. "Burn them," I said. "The wallet I would dispose of tomorrow, along with the license plates, the plastic bag, and the ashes." When I handed him a glass of rye, I saw the red scar on his hand. "Here's to the major," Bon said. The medicinal taste of the rye was so awful, we had a second drink to wash it away, then a third, and so forth, all while watching television specials celebrating the nation's birthday. It was not just any birthday, but the bicentennial of a great, brawny nation, a little punch drunk from recent foreign excursions, but now on its feet again and ready to swing, or so proclaimed the chatterati. Then we ate 3 of the oranges and went to bed. I lay down on my bunk, closed my eyes, knocked my knees against the rearranged furniture of my thoughts, and shuddered at what I saw. I opened my eyes, but it made no difference. No matter whether my eyes were open or shut, I could still see it. The crapulent major's third eye, weeping, because of what it could see about me. Chapter 7 I confess the Major's death troubled me greatly, Commandant, even if it does not trouble you. He was a relatively innocent man, which was the best one could hope for in this world. In Saigon, I could have depended on my weekly visits to the Basilica with Nan to discuss my misgivings. But here, I was alone with myself, my deeds, and my beliefs. I knew what Nan would say to me, but I just needed him to say to me again, as he had on other occasions, such as the time I passed to him a cartridge of film recording the Helleborn assault plans of a Ranger battalion. Innocent men would die as a result of my actions, wouldn't they? Of course men will die, Man said, masking his words behind his folded hands as we knelt in a pew. But they aren't innocent. Neither are we, my friend. We're revolutionaries, and revolutionaries can never be innocent. We know too much and have done too much. I shivered in the humid climate of the Basilica while the dowagers droned. As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen. Contrary to some perceptions, revolutionary ideology, even in a tropical country, is not hot. It is cold, man-made. A little surprise, then, that revolutionaries needed natural heat sometimes. Thus, when I received an invitation to a wedding not long after the crapulent Major's demise, I accepted with enthusiasm. Sophia Mori was my curious guest to this reception for a couple whose names I had to check on the invitation before greeting them. The bride's father was a legendary Marine colonel whose battalion fought off an NVA regiment during the Battle of Hue, with no American resistance, while the groom's father was the vice president of the Saigon branch of Bank of America. His family had fled Saigon on a jet chartered by Bank of America, thus avoiding the indignity of the refugees' camp. The most distinctive thing about the vice president, besides his air of effortless distinction, was the Clark Gable mustache playing dead on his upper lip, an adornment favored by southern men who fancied themselves debonair playboys. I had received an invitation since I had met the man several times in Saigon as the general's aide. My status was indicated by how far I sat from the stage, which is to say, very far. We were positioned near the restrooms, buffered from the scent of disinfectant only by the tables for the children and the band. Our companions were a couple of former junior officers, two mid-tier bank executives, who had found lower-tier jobs with Bank of America branches, an in-law who looked inbred, and their wives. In dire times, I would not merit a seat, but now we were more than a year into our American exile, and flush times had returned for some. A Chinese restaurant was in Westminster, where the man with the Clark Gable mustache had settled his family in a ranch-style suburban home, a demotion from his villa in Saigon, but many rungs above almost all of the evening's attendees. Westminster was Sonny's town, and I spotted him at a table several rings closer to the center of power, Clark Gable's attempt to ensure positive press coverage. Despite the noise and activity in the restaurant, where Chinese waiters tucked into red jackets scurried through the maze of banquet tables, a touch of melancholy pervaded the huge dining room. The bride's father was notably absent, captured along with the remnants of his battalion as they defended the western approach to Saigon on the last day. The general praised him at the beginning of the banquet in a speech that stirred emotions, tears, and drinks. All the veterans toasted the hero with voluble bursts of bravado that helped to obscure their own uncomfortable lack of heroism. One simply must grin and drink unless one wants to sink to one's neck in the quicksands of contradiction. Or so said the sad, crapulent major, his severed head serving as the table's centerpiece. So I grinned and poured cognac down my throat. Then I mixed a libation of Remy Martin and soda for Miss Mori, while explaining the exotic customs, habits, hairstyles, and fashion of our fun-loving people. I yelled my explanations, struggling to be heard over the loud cover band that was fronted by a petite dude in a sequined blazer. He sported a glam rocker's perm, modeled on a Louis XIV wig minus the powder, and strutted on gold platform shoes while fondling his mic, pressing the ball of it to his lips suggestively as he sang. The heterosexually certified bankers and military men absolutely loved him, roaring approval at every flagrant pelvic gesture of flirtation from the singer's extraordinarily tight satin pants. When the singer invited manly men to the stage for a dance, it was the general who immediately offered himself. He grinned as he sashayed with the singer to Black is Black, the theme song of riotous Saigonese decadence, the audience cheering and clapping in appreciation, the singer winking over his shoulders a la Mae West. This was the general's element, among men and women who appreciated him, or who knew better than to voice any disagreements or discomfort with him. The execution, no, the neutralization of the poor crapulent major had pumped life back into him, enough so that he had masterfully eulogized at the funeral. There he praised the major as a quietly self-sacrificial and humble man who always performed his duties to country and family without complaint, only to be tragically cut down in a senseless robbery. I had taken photographs of the funeral with my Kodak, the images later dispatched to my aunt in Paris while Sonny sat in the front row of mourners taking notes for an obituary. After the funeral, the general slipped the widow an envelope of cash from the operational funds provided by Claude, then stooped to peer into the bassinet where spinach and broccoli slept. As for myself, I could only mumble something generically appropriate to the widow, whose veil cloaked a waterfall of tears. "How was it?" Bond asked when I came home. "How do you think?" I said, heading for the refrigerator, its ribs lined as always with beer. Besides my conscience, my liver was the most abused part of my body. Weddings often exacerbated the abuse aggravated by the sight of a happy, innocent bride and groom. Their marriage might lead to alienation, adultery, misery, and divorce, but it might also lead to affection, loyalty, children, and contentment. While I had no desire to be married, weddings reminded me of what had been denied me through no choice of my own. Thus, if I began every wedding as a pulp movie tough guy, mixing laughs with the occasional cynical comment, I ended each wedding as a watered-down cocktail, one-third singing, one-third sentimental, and one-third sorrowful. It was in this state that I took Miss Morey to the dance floor after the wedding cake was cut, and it was then, near the stage, that I recognized one of the two female singers taking turns at the microphone with our gay blade. She was the general's oldest daughter, safely ensconced in the Bay Area as a student while the country collapsed. Lana was nearly unrecognizable from the schoolgirl I had seen at the general's villa during her lycée years and on summer vacations. In those days, her name was still Lan, and she wore the most modest of clothing. The schoolgirl's white owl dye that had sent many a Western writer into near pederastic fantasies about the nubile bodies whose every curve was revealed without displaying an inch of flesh except above the neck and below the cuffs. This the writers apparently took as an implicit metaphor for our country as a whole, wanton and yet withdrawn, hinting at everything and giving away nothing, in a dazzling display of demureness, a paradoxical incitement to temptation, a breathtakingly lewd exhibition of modesty. Hardly any male travel writer, journalist, or casual observer of our country's life could restrain himself about writing about the young girls who rode their bicycles to and from school and those fluttering white owl dye, butterflies that every Western man dreamed of pinning to his collection. In reality, Lan was a tomboy who had to be straitjacketed into her owl dye every morning by Madame or a nanny. Her ultimate form of rebellion was to be a superb student who, like me, earned a scholarship to the States. In her case, the scholarship was from the University of California at Berkeley, which the general and Madame regarded as a communist colony of radical professors and revolutionary students out to beguile and bed the innocents. They wanted to send her to a girls' college where the only danger was lesbian seduction, but Lan had applied to none of them, insisting on Berkeley. When they forbade her from going, Lan threatened suicide. Neither the general nor Madame took her seriously until Lan swallowed a fistful of sleeping pills. Thankfully, she had a small fist. After nursing her back to health, the general was willing to concede, but Madame was not. Lan threw herself into the Saigon River one afternoon, albeit at a time when the quay was well stocked with pedestrians, two of whom jumped in to save her as she floated in her white aodai. At last, Madame Tu conceded, and Lan flew off to Berkeley to study art history in the fall of 72, a major her parents felt would enhance her feminine sensibilities and keep her suitable for marriage. During her returns home in the summers of 73 and 74, she reappeared as a foreigner in bell-bottom jeans and feathered hair, blouses stretched tight as a trampoline over the swell of her bosom, clogs adding several inches to her modest height. Madame would sit her down in her salon and, according to the nannies, lecture her on the importance of maintaining her virginity and of cultivating the three submissions and four virtues, a phrase that calls to mind the title of a highbrow erotic novel. The mere mention of her endangered or putatively lost virginity provided ample wood for the cook stove of my imagination, a fire I stoked in the privacy of my room, down the hall from the one she shared with a little sister. Lan had visited the General and Madame a few times since our arrival in California, but I had not been invited to the home on such occasions, nor had I been invited to go with the General and Madame to her graduation cum laude a few months before. The most I heard of Lan was when the General muttered something about his unfilial daughter, who was now going by the name of Lana, and who had not returned home after graduation, but instead chosen to live on her own. Although I tried to draw out the General on what Lana was doing post-graduation, he had been uncharacteristically incommunicative. Now I knew, and now I knew why. This Lana on stage bore no relationship to the Lan that I remembered. In the band's arrangements, the other female singer was the angel of tradition, clad in a chartreuse aodai, hair long and straight, makeup tasteful, her songs of choice, estrogen-soaked ballads about lovelorn women hailing distant soldier lovers, or lost Saigon itself. No such sadness or lost-tinted Lana's song, no looking backward over the shoulder of this temptress of modernity. Even I was shocked by the black leather miniskirt that threatened to reveal a glimpse of that secret I had so often fantasized about. Above the miniskirt, her gold silk halter top shimmered with every gyration of her torso as she flexed her lungs, her specialty being the rock'em sock'em numbers that the blues and rock bands of our homeland had mastered in order to entertain American troops and Americanized youth. I had heard her sing Proud Mary earlier in the evening without realizing it was she, and now I had to remind myself not to stare at her as she let loose a throaty version of Twist and Shout that called nearly everyone under the age of 40 to the dance floor. Besides the simple yet elegant cha-cha, the twist was the favorite dance of the Southern people, requiring, as it did, no coordination. Even Madame usually did the twist, innocent enough that she allowed her children to flock to the floor and dance too. But glancing at the General's table, which occupied a place of honor on the dance floor's edge, I saw both the General and the Madame remaining seated, looking as if they were sucking on the sour fruit of the tamarind tree that had shaded their lost villa. And no wonder, for no one was twisting more than Lana herself, every rotation of her hips working an invisible ratchet that pulled the heads of the men on the dance floor forward and then pushed back. I might have participated if I was not so aware of Miss Maury dancing next to me, twisting with such childlike glee that I had to smile. She was looking remarkably feminine compared with her usual style. A lily nestled in her marceled hair, and she wore a chiffon dress that actually exposed her knees. I had flattered her more than once on her appearance, and I took the occasion of seeing her knees during the twist to compliment her on her dancing as well. "I haven't danced like that in a long time," she said when the song was over. "Neither have I, Miss Maury," I said, kissing her on the cheek. "Sophia," she said. Before I could respond, Clark Gable took to the stage and announced a surprise visitor, a congressman who served in our country as a Green Beret from 62 to 64, and who was the representative for this district we found ourselves in. The congressman had achieved a significant degree of renown in Southern California as an up-and-coming young politician. his martial credentials serving him well in Orange County. Here, his nicknames of Napalm Ned, or Knock 'em Dead Ned, or Nuke 'em All Ned, used depending on one's mood and the geopolitical crisis, were affectionate rather than derogatory. He was so anti-red in his politics, he might as well have been green. One reason, he was one of the few politicians in Southern California to greet the refugees with open arms. The majority of Americans regarded us with ambivalence, if not outright distaste. We being living reminders of their stinging defeat. We threatened the sanctity and symmetry of a white and black America whose yin and yang racial politics left no room for any other color, particularly that of pathetic little yellow-skinned people pickpocketing the American purse. We were strange aliens rumored to have a prediction for Fido Americanus, the domestic canine on whom was lavished more per capita than the annual income of a starving Bangladeshi family. The true horror of the situation was actually beyond the ken of the average American. While some of us indeed had been known to sup on the brethren of Rin-Tin-Tin and Lassie, we did not do so in the Neanderthal-esque way imagined by the average American, with a club, a roast, and some salt, but with a gourmand's depth of ingenuity and creativity. Our chefs able to cook canids 7 different virility-enhancing ways, from extracting the marrow to grilling and boiling, as well as sausage-making, stewing, and a few varieties of frying and steaming. Yum! The congressman, however, had written editorials defending us and welcoming the émigré to his Orange County district. "Good God, look at you," he said, with microphone in hand, Clark Gable by his side, flanked by Angel and Temptress. He was in his 40s, a crossbreed between lawyer and politician, exhibiting the former's aggressiveness and the latter's smoothness, typified by his head, shiny, polished, and pointed as the tip of a fountain pen. Words flowed from it as easily as the finest India ink. This head was the difference in height between him and the shorter Clark Gable, and in every dimension was the congressman so much more expansive that 2 Vietnamese men of average height and size could have squeezed themselves into the confines of his body. "Look at yourselves, ladies and gentlemen. Look at yourselves the way I wish my fellow Americans would look at you, which is as fellow Americans. I am truly thankful for the chance to be here tonight and to share in the joy of this occasion, this marriage of 2 lovely young Vietnamese people in a Chinese restaurant on California soil, under an American moon, and in a Christian universe. Let me tell you something, ladies and gentlemen. For 2 years I lived among your people in the highlands and fought with your soldiers and shared your fears and faced your enemy. And I thought then, and I think now, how I could do nothing finer with my life than sacrifice it in the cause of your hopes, dreams, and aspirations for a better life. While I believe as surely as you that those hopes, dreams, and aspirations would be fulfilled in your homeland, we have been dealt another hand by history and the mysterious and unquestionable grace of God. I am here to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that this is a hand of temporary bad luck. For your soldiers fought well and bravely, and would have prevailed if only Congress had remained as steadfast in their support of you as the President promised. This was a promise shared by many, many Americans, but not all. You know who I mean. The Democrats, the media, the anti-war movement, the hippies, the college students, the radicals. America was weakened by its own internal divisions, by the defeatists and communists and traitors infesting our universities, our newsrooms, and our Congress. You, sad to say, merely remind them of their cowardice and their treachery. I am here to tell you that what you remind me of is America's great promise, the promise of the immigrant, the promise of the American dream, the promise that the people of this country used to hold dear and will one day soon hold dear again, that America is a land of freedom and independence, a land of patriots who have always stood up for the little man no matter where he is in the world, a land of heroes who will never relent in the cause of helping our friends and smiting our enemies, a land that welcomes people like you, who have sacrificed so much in our common cause of democracy and liberty. One day, my friends, America will stand tall again, and it will be because of people like you. And one day, my friends, the land you have lost will be yours again, because nothing can stop the inevitable movement of freedom and the will of the people. Now, affirm with me in your beautiful language what we all believe. The entire audience had been cheering and applauding wildly throughout the speech, and if he had rolled out a communist in a cage, the spectators would have gladly called for him to rip out the Red's beating heart with his massive fists. There was no way he could possibly get them even more excited, but he did, raising his arms to form a V, presumably for victory, or for Vietnam, or for vote for me, or for something even more subliminally suggestive. He shouted into the microphone in the most perfect Vietnamese, "Vietnam, Muon Nam! Vietnam, Muon Nam! Vietnam, Muon Nam!" Everyone sitting leaped to his or her feet, and everyone standing stood a little taller, and everyone roared after the congressman the refrain of, "Vietnam forever!" Then Clark Gable made a motion to the band, and it swung into the rhythms of our national anthem, which the angel and the temptress and Clark Gable and the congressman all sang with zeal, as did everyone in the audience, myself included, except for the stoic Chinese waiters, who could finally take a rest. When the anthem finished, the congressman was mobbed by well-wishers on stage, while the rest of the audience members sunk into their seats with post-coital smugness. I turned to Sonny, notepad and pen in hand, standing by Miss Morey. "Funny," he said, pink from a glass or two of cognac. "It's the same slogan the Communist Party uses." Miss Morey shrugged. "Slogan is just an empty suit," she said. "Anyone can wear it." "I like that," Sonny said. "Mind if I use it?" I introduced the two of them and asked him if he was going to get up close for a photograph. He grinned. "The newspaper has been doing well enough for me to hire a photographer. As for me, I already interviewed the good congressman. I should have worn a flak jacket. He was practically shooting bullets at me." "Typical white man behavior," Miss Morey said. "Have you ever noticed how a white man can learn a few words of some Asian language and we just eat it up? He could have asked for a glass of water and we'd treat him like Einstein." Sonny smiled and wrote that down, too. "You've been here longer than we have, Miss Morey," he said with some admiration. "Have you noticed that when we Asians speak English, it better be nearly perfect or someone's going to make fun of our accent?" "It doesn't matter how long you've been here," Miss Morey said. "White people will always think we're foreigners." "But isn't there another side to that?" I said, my words a little slurred from the cognac in my bloodstream. "If we speak perfect English, then Americans can trust us. It makes it easier for them to think we're one of them." "You're that kind of person, right?" Sonny's eyes were as opaque as the tinted windows of a car. I was mistaken about him having changed that much. In the few times we had seen each other since our initial reunion, he had shown that he had merely turned down the volume on his personality. "So, what do you think of our congressman?" "Are you going to quote me?" "You'll be an anonymous source." "He's the best thing that could have happened to us," I said. And that was no lie. It was, instead, the best kind of truth, the one that meant at least two things. The next weekend provided further opportunity to refine my understanding of the congressman's potential. On a bright Sunday morning, I chauffeured the general and madame from Hollywood to Huntington Beach, where the congressman lived and where he had invited them for lunch. My title of chauffeur was more impressive than the vehicle, a Chevrolet Nova, whose best feature was its relative newness. But the fact remained that the general and the madame, nestled in the back seat, had a chauffeur. My function was to be a trapping of their past and possibly future life. Their conversation for the hour-long drive revolved mostly around the congressman until I asked about Lana, who, I said, struck me as having become all grown up. In the rearview mirror, I saw Madame's face darken with barely repressed fury. "She's completely insane," Madame declared. "We've been trying to keep her insanity within the family, but now that she's strutting in public as a singer," Madame said the word as if it were communist, "there's nothing we can do. Someone persuaded her that she had talent as a singer, and she took the compliment seriously." "She is rather talented," I said. "Don't start. Don't encourage her. Look at her. She looks like a slut. Is this what I raised her to be? What decent man would want to marry that? Would you, Captain?" Our eyes met in the rearview mirror. "No, Madame," I said. "I wouldn't want to marry that. Also the two-faced truth. For marriage was not the first thing on my mind when I saw her on stage." "Of course not," she fumed. "The worst thing about living in America is the corruption. At home, we could contain it in the bars and nightclubs and bases, but here, we will not be able to protect our children from the lewdness and the shallowness and the tawdriness Americans love so much. They're too permissive. No one even thinks twice of what they call dating. We all know that date is a euphemism. What parent not only allows their daughter to copulate in her teenage years, but willingly encourages it? It's shocking. It's an abnegation of moral responsibility. Ugh." Somehow, at lunch, the conversation turned exactly in this direction, allowing Madame to repeat her points to the congressman and his wife, Rita, a refugee from Castro's revolution. She bore a passing resemblance to Rita Hayworth, with 10 or 15 years and pounds added to the movie star at her most glamorous period, circa Gilda. "Castro," she said, in the way Madame said singer, "is the devil. The only good thing about living with the devil, General and Madame, is that one knows evil and can recognize it. That is why I am happy you are here today, because we Cubans and Vietnamese are cousins in our shared cause against communism." These words sealed the bond between the congressman and Rita and the general and Madame, who was comfortable enough that she eventually mentioned Lana to them while the mute housekeeper policed the empty dishes. Rita immediately sympathized. She was the domestic equivalent of her husband, an anti-communist warrior housewife to whom nothing was just an isolated incident, but was almost always a symptom by which the disease of communism could be linked to poverty, depravity, atheism, and decay of many kinds. "I won't allow rock music in this house," she said, gripping Madame's hand to console her for the loss of her daughter's virtue. "None of my children will be allowed to date until 18, and, so long as they live in this house, we'll have a curfew by 10. It's our weak spot, this freedom we allow people to behave any way they please, what with their drugs and their sex, as if those things aren't infectious." "Every system has its excesses that must be checked internally," the congressman said. "We let the hippies steal the meaning of the words love and freedom, and we've only just begun to fight back. That fight begins and ends in the home." Unlike his public persona, the congressman in private was soft-spoken and measured in his tones, baronially assured as he sat at the head of the table, the general and Madame to either side. "We control what our children read and listen to and watch, but it's a tough fight when they can just turn on the television or radio any time they want. We need the government to make sure Hollywood and the record labels don't go too far." "Aren't you the government?" the general said. "Exactly, which is why one of my priorities is legislation that regulates movies and music. This is not censorship, only advice with teeth. But you can bet the Hollywood and music types don't like me at all, until they meet me, that is. And see, I'm not some kind of ogre out to feast on their creations. I'm just trying to help them refine their product. Now, one thing that happened as a consequence of my work on the subcommittee is that I became friendly with some of the Hollywood people. I'll admit I had my prejudices about them, but some of them are actually smart and passionate guys, too. Smart and passionate. That's what I care about. The rest, we negotiate. Anyway, one of them is making a movie about the war and wanted my advice. I'm going to give him some notes on his script about what he got right and wrong. But the reason I mention it to you, General, is because the story is about the Phoenix program. And I know you're an expert on that. Me, I left before that even got started. Maybe you can give some feedback. Otherwise, who knows the kind of Hollywood story they're going to make. This is why I have my captain, the general said, nodding toward me. He is, in effect, my cultural attaché. He would be more than happy to read the screenplay and offer his insight. When I asked the congressman for the title, I was taken aback. Hamlet? No, The Hamlet. The director is also the writer. Never served a day in the armed forces. Just got fed John Wayne and Audie Murphy movies as a kid. The main character is a Green Beret who has to save a Hamlet. I did serve 2 years on an A-team in a number of Hamlets, but nothing like this fantasy land he's cooked up. I'll see what I can do, I said. I had lived in a northern Hamlet only a few years as a young boy, before our flight south in 54. But lack of experience had never stopped me from trying anything. This was my mindset when I approached Lana after her commanding performance, my intent to congratulate her on her new career. We stood in the restaurant's foyer by an imposing photograph of the newlyweds displayed on an easel, and it was here that she studied me with the objective, unsentimental eye of an art appraiser. She smiled and said, "I was wondering why you were keeping your distance from me, Captain." When I protested that I simply had not recognized her, she asked me if I liked what I saw. "I don't look like the girl you knew, do I, Captain?" Some men preferred those innocent schoolgirls in their white-owl dye, but not me. They belonged to some pastoral, pure vision of our culture from which I was excluded, as distant to me as the snow-capped peaks of my father's homeland. No, I was impure, and impurity was all I wanted and all I deserved. "You don't look like the girl I knew," I said, "but you look exactly like the woman I imagine you would one day become." No one had ever said anything like this to her, and the unexpected nature of my remark made her falter for a moment before she recovered. "I see. I'm not the only person who's changed since coming here, Captain. You're so much more direct than you were when you lived with us." "I don't live with you any longer," I said. If Madame had not appeared at that moment, who knew where the conversation would have taken us then? Without a word to me, she seized Lana by the elbow and pulled her toward the ladies' room with a force that would not be denied. Although that was the last I saw of her for quite a while, she returned in my fantasies many times over the subsequent weeks. Regardless of what I wanted or deserved, she inevitably appeared in a white owl dye, her long black hair sometimes framing her face and sometimes obscuring it. In the nameless dream city where I encountered her, my shadow self wavered. Even in my somnambulant state, I knew that white was not the only color of purity and innocence. It was also the sign of mourning and death. Chapter 8. We own the day, but Charlie owns the night. Never forget that. These are the words that blonde 21-year-old Sergeant J. Bellamy hears on his first day in the torrid tropics of Nam from his new commanding officer, Captain Will Seamus. Seamus was baptized in the blood of his own comrades on the beaches of Normandy, survived another near-death experience under a Chinese human wave attack in Korea, then hauled himself up the ranks on a pulley oiled with Jack Daniels. He knows he will not ascend any higher, not with his Bronx manners and his big, knobby knuckles over which no velvet gloves fit. "This is a political war," he informs his acolyte, the words emanating from behind a smokescreen produced by a Cuban cigar. "But all I know was a killing war. His task? Save the pre-lapsarian Montagnards of a bucolic hamlet perched on the border of wild Laos. What's threatening them is the Viet Cong, and not just any Viet Cong. This is the baddest of the bad. King Kong. King Kong will die for his country, which is more than can be said for most Americans. More important, King Kong will kill for his country, and nothing makes King Kong lick his lips like the ferric scent of the white man's blood. King Kong has stocked the dense jungle around the hamlet with veteran guerrillas, battle-wizened men and women, who have slaughtered Frenchmen from the highlands to the street without joy. What's more, King Kong has infiltrated the hamlet with subversives and sympathizers, friendly faces only masked for calculating wills. Standing against them are the hamlet's popular forces, a ragtag bunch of farmers and teenagers, Vietnam's own Minutemen, trained by the dozen Green Berets of the U.S. Army Special Forces A-Team. This is enough, Sergeant Bellamy thinks, alone in his watchtower at midnight. He's dropped out of Harvard and run far from his St. Louis home, his millionaire daddy and his fur-cloaked mother. This is enough, this stunningly beautiful jungle and these humble, simple people. This is where I, J. Bellamy, make my first and maybe my last stand, at the Hamlet. This, at any rate, was my interpretation of the screenplay mailed to me by the director's personal assistant, the thickish manila envelope arriving with my name misspelled in a beautifully cursive hand. That was the first whiff of trouble, the second being how the personal assistant, Violet, did not even bother to say hello or goodbye when she called for my mailing information and to arrange a meeting with the director in his Hollywood Hills home. When Violet opened the door, she continued with her bewildering manner of discourse in person. "Glad to see you could make it. Heard a lot about you. Loved your notes on the Hamlet." And that's precisely how she spoke, trimming pronouns and periods as if punctuation and grammar were wasted on me. Then, without deigning to make eye contact, she inclined her head in a gesture of condescension and disdain, signaling me to enter. Perhaps her abruptness was merely part of her personality, for she had the appearance of the worst kind of bureaucrat, the aspiring one, from blunt, square haircut to blunt, clean fingernails to blunt, efficient pumps. But perhaps it was me, still morally disoriented from the crapulent major's death, as well as the apparition of his severed head at the wedding banquet. The emotional residue of that night was like a drop of arsenic falling into the still waters of my soul. Nothing having changed from the taste of it, but everything now tainted. So perhaps that was why when I crossed over the threshold into the marble foyer, I instantly suspected that the cause of her behavior was my race. What she saw when she looked at me must have been my yellowness, my slightly smaller eyes, and the shadow cast by the ill fame of the Oriental's genitals, though supposedly minuscule privates disparaged on many a public restroom wall by semi-illiterates. I might have been just half an Asian, but in America it was all or nothing when it came to race. You are either white or you weren't. Funnily enough, I had never felt inferior because of my race during my foreign student days. I was foreign by definition and therefore was treated as a guest. But now, even though I was a card-carrying American with a driver's license, social security card, and resident alien permit, Violet still considered me as foreign, and this misrecognition punctured the smooth skin of my self-confidence. Was I just being paranoid, that all-American characteristic? Maybe Violet was stricken with color blindness, the willful inability to distinguish between white and any other color, the only infirmity Americans wished for themselves. But as she advanced along the polished bamboo floors, steering clear of the dusky maid vacuuming a Turkish rug, I just knew it could not be so. The flawlessness of my English did not matter. Even if she could hear me, she still saw right through me, or perhaps saw someone else instead of me. Her retinas burned with the images of all the castrati dreamed up by Hollywood to steal the place of real Asian men. Here I speak of those cartoons named Fu Manchu, Charlie Chan, Number One Son, Hop Sing, Hop Sing, and the buck-tooth, bespectacled Jap not so much played as mocked by Mickey Rooney in Breakfast at Tiffany's. The performance was so insulting it even deflated my fetish for Audrey Hepburn, understanding as I did her implicit endorsement of such loathsomeness. By the time I sat down opposite the director in his office, I was seething from the memory of all those previous wounds, although I did not show it. On the one hand, I was sitting for a meeting with the famed auteur, when once I was just another lovelorn movie fan passing Saturday afternoons in the cinematic bliss of matinee screenings, from which I emerged, blinking and slightly shocked, into sunlight as bright as the fluorescent bulbs of a hospital birthing room. On the other hand, I was flummoxed by having read a screenplay whose greatest special effect was neither the blowing up of various things nor the evisceration of various bodies, but the achievement of narrating a movie about our country where not a single one of our countrymen had an intelligible word to say. Violet had scraped my already chafed ethnic sensitivity even further, but since it would not do to make my irritation evident, I forced myself to smile and do what I did best, remaining as unreadable as a paper package wrapped up with string. The auteur studied me, this extra who had crept into the middle of his perfect mise-en-scene. A golden Oscar statuette exhibited itself to the side of his telephone, serving as either a kingly scepter or a mace for braining impertinent screenwriters. A hirsute show of manliness ruffled along his forearms, and from the collar of his shirt, reminding me of my own relative hairlessness, my chest and stomach and buttocks, as streamlined and glabrous as a Ken doll. He was the hottest writer-director in town after the triumph of his last two films, beginning with Hard Knock, a critically lauded movie about the travails of Greek-American youth in the inflamed streets of Detroit. It was loosely autobiographical, the auteur having been born with an olive-tinged Greek surname he had bleached in typical Hollywood fashion. His most recent film declared that he had had enough with off-white ethnicity, exploring cocaine-white ethnicity instead. Venice Beach was about the failure of the American dream, featuring a dipsomaniac reporter and his depressive wife writing competing versions of the great American novel. As the fool's cap mounted endlessly, their money and their lives slowly drained away, leaving the audience with a last image of the couple's dilapidated cottage strangled by bougainvillea while beautifully lit by the sun setting beyond the Pacific. It was Didion crossed with Chandler, as prophesied by Faulkner and shot by Wells. It was very good. He had talent, no matter how much it might have pained me to say so. "Great to meet you," the author began. "Loved your notes. How about something to drink? Coffee, tea, water, soda, scotch? Never too early for scotch. Violet, some scotch. Ice." I said ice. "No ice, then." "Me too. Always neat for me. Look at my view. No, not at the gardener. Jose, Jose, go to pound on the glass to get his attention. He's half deaf. Jose, move! You're blocking the view. Good. See the view? I'm talking about the Hollywood sign right there. Never get tired of it. Like the word of God just dropped down, plunked on the hills, and the word was Hollywood. Didn't God say, let there be light first? What's a movie but light? Can't have a movie without light, and then words. Seeing that sign reminds me to write every morning. What? All right, so it doesn't say Hollywood. You got me. Good eye. Things falling to pieces. One O's half fallen, the other O's fallen altogether. The word's gone to shit. So what? You still get the meaning. Thanks, Violet. Cheers. How do they say it in your country? I said, how do they say it? Yo, 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 is it? I like that. Easy to remember. Yo, 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 then. And here's to the congressman for sending you my way. You're the first Vietnamese I've ever met. Not too many of you in Hollywood. Hell, none of you in Hollywood. And authenticity is important. Not that authenticity beats imagination. The story comes first. The universality of the story has to be there, but it doesn't hurt to get the details right. I had a Green Beret who actually fought with the Montagnards vet the script. He found me. He had a screenplay. Everyone has a screenplay. Can't write, but he's a real American hero. Two tours of duty, killed VC with his bare hands, a silver star and a purple heart with oak leaf clusters. You should have seen the Polaroids he showed me. Made my stomach turn. Gave me some ideas, though, for how to shoot the movie. Hardly had any corrections to make. What do you think of that? It took me a moment to realize he was asking me a question. I was disoriented, as if I were in English as a second language speaker, listening to an equally foreign speaker from another country. That's great, I said. You bet it's great. You, on the other hand, you wrote me another screenplay in the margins. You ever even read a screenplay before? It took me another moment to realize there was another question. Like Violet, he had a problem with conventional punctuation. No, I didn't think so. So why do you think, but you didn't get the details right? I didn't get the details right. Violet, hear that? I researched your country, my friend. I read Joseph Budinger and Francis Fitzgerald. Have you read Joseph Budinger and Francis Fitzgerald? He's the foremost historian on your little part of the world, and she won the Pulitzer Prize. She dissected your psychology. I think I know something about you people. His aggressiveness flustered me, and my flustering, which I was not accustomed to, only flustered me further, which was my only explanation for my forthcoming behavior. You didn't even get the screams right, I said. Excuse me? I waited for an interjection until I realized he was just interrupting me with a question. All right, I said, my string starting to unravel. If I remember correctly, pages 26, 42, 58, 77, 91, 103, and 118, basically all the places in the script where one of my people has a speaking part, he or she screams. No words, just screams. So you should at least get the screams right. Screams are universal, am I right, Violet? You're right, she said from where she sat next to me. Screams are not universal, I said. If I took this telephone cord and wrapped it around your neck and pulled it tight until your eyes bugged out and your tongue turned black, Violet's scream would sound very different from the scream you would be trying to make. Those are two very different kinds of terror coming from a man and a woman. The man knows he is dying. The woman fears she is likely to die soon. Their situations and their bodies produce a qualitatively different timbre to their voices. One must listen to them carefully to understand that while pain is universal, it is also utterly private. We cannot know whether our pain is like anybody else's pain until we talk about it. Once we do that, we speak and think in ways cultural and individual. In this country, for example, someone fleeing for his life will think he should call for the police. This is a reasonable way to cope with the threat of pain. But in my country, no one calls for the police, since it is often the police who inflict the pain. Am I right, Violet? Violet mutely nodded her head. So let me just point out that in your script, you have my people scream the following way. Aiee! For example, when Villager 3 is impaled by a Viet Cong punji trap, this is how he screams. Or when the little girl sacrifices her life to alert the Green Berets to the Viet Cong sneaking into the village, this is how she screams before her throat is cut. But having heard many of my countrymen screaming in pain, I can assure you this is not how they scream. Would you like to hear how they scream? His Adam's apple bobbed as he swallowed. Okay. I stood up and leaned on the desk to look right into his eyes, but I didn't see him. What I saw was the face of the wiry Montagnard, an elder of the Brew minority who lived in a natural hamlet not far from the setting of this fiction. Rumor had it he served as a liaison agent for the Viet Cong. I was on my first assignment as a lieutenant and could not figure out a way to save the man from my captain, wrapping a strand of rusted barbed wire around his throat, the necklace tight enough so that each time he swallowed, the wire tickled his Adam's apple. That was not what made the old man scream, however. It was just an appetizer. In my mind, though, as I watched the scene, I screamed for him. Here's what it sounds like, I said, reaching across the desk to pick up the auteur's Mont Blanc fountain pen. I wrote onomatopoeically across the cover page of the screenplay in black letters, "Aya!" Then I capped his pen, put it back on his leather writing pad, and said, "That's how we scream in my country." After I descended from the auteur's home to the general's, 30 blocks distant and down the hill to the Hollywood flatlands, I reported my first experience with the motion picture industry to the general and madame, both of whom were infuriated on my behalf. My meeting with the auteur and Violet had gone on for a little while longer, mostly in a more subdued fashion.